Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to .foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the Asia Now film series, and we will be talking about Cinco de Mayo. I'm delighted now to welcome Jim Lehrer. He's executive editor and anchor of PBS NewsHour. He's the author of 3 plays, 2 memoirs, and 20 novels, the latest of which is called Super. And he will be at Bookworks in Albuquerque tonight at 7 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So let's talk about your novel. Of course, I, as probably many of our listeners, didn't know that you were a novelist. And this is a very suspenseful book that takes its title from the Super Chief Train of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway. Most of the action of the book takes place there. What was special about this train?
Well, it was kind of the, it was the ultimate luxury train in America. It went from Chicago to Los Angeles. It was called the Train of the Stars because so many movie stars rode the thing. They'd go from Chicago, from Los Angeles to Chicago. They'd have lunch at the Pump Room, and then they would take the 20th Century Limited or the Broadway Limited to New York. But it was all sleeper car. In other words, all bedrooms. It had the fresh food that was delivered and served in this fabulous dining car. The train would stop. And people would put on fresh trout that had just been caught. They would stop at a bakery in Newton, Kansas, where there'd be freshly baked bread. The wines were superb. The china was thick and heavy, and so was the silverware. There was a barber shop on the train. It was all kinds of not only movie stars, but politicians and musicians and baseball players. It was literally the Train of the Stars. And in my story, it's in 1956, the spring of 1956, April 1956, where I have basically one round trip, where I have Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert and Harry Truman on my fictional trip, even though those are real people. I have 2 or 3 dead bodies by the time it's all over. It's essentially one round trip, one trip from Chicago to Los Angeles and a return trip back to Chicago. But it's a mystery, but it also has some other things going for it as well, I think.
So 1956, that was a time when airplane travel was, I guess, starting to kind of eclipse the trains as the luxury mode of travel. Was the train kind of hanging on for dear life, or was it still holding its own as a luxurious way to get to L.A.?
It was not quite just holding on, but it was beginning to diminish. Its glories were about to diminish. And there were only a few really holdout movie stars and other stars, one of them being Clark Gable. He was the king of Hollywood. He also was the king of the super chief. His wife, the actress Carol Lombard, was killed in an airplane crash toward the end of World War II. Gable himself had been an aviator in World War II, but after Carol Lombard died, he decided he didn't want to fly anymore if he didn't have to. But Judy Garland still rode the train, but a lot of them, like people like William Holden, a lot of the stars that used to go on the train, they switched to airplanes. But there were other transitions going on at the same time in 1956. In the movie business, television was beginning to take over, and a lot of the movie people who had felt that movies were the pure medium were reluctant to go into television, and so there were strains there. So 56 was, and also there was nuclear testing going on, and there was some discussion of that with Harry Truman, because he's the man who dropped the A-bomb, and a lot of changes during that particular period in 1956.
Yeah, 1956, I mean, the war was over for 11 years, and people were still really thinking about, I mean, the blasts of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were still fresh in people's minds.
Absolutely.
And hearts.
And the Korean War had just finished, and the special interest I had in 1956, that was the year I graduated from college at the University of Missouri, and the year I went into the Marine Corps for 3 years. And so 56 is, that period was, uh, was a for me personally was a critical time too. So I was another all that did it was just kind of focus a lot of attention on that particular period because I lived through it in a very for me an important time in my life as well.
And a good part of the action of the book takes place in Kansas, which is your home state.
Exactly.
Did you ride trains like that in your youth?
Well, I didn't. I worked. That was above above our means to ride those streamliners. Those were for folks with means, and we didn't have those kind of means. My dad worked in the bus business in Kansas. He worked for a bus company. It's called Santa Fe Trailways. In fact, it went through Santa Fe, and it was owned by the Santa Fe Railroad. So he had a railroad connection to the Santa Fe Railroad, but they gave him a pass to ride the railroad, but he couldn't ride on any of the streamliners. He could only ride on the cheap chair cars. So that was not part of our life. But what it was a part of our part of my life was it was part of kind of the dream machines that you have when you're a kid and you see those silver streaks come through the plains. You say, one day I'm going to get on one of those things. I'm going to run away from home, or I'm going to go to war, or I'm going to go to love, I'm going to go to school, I'm going to do something, or I'm just going to run away. And later, buses with, you know, provided the same kind of dream machine vehicle for us all, for kids who grew up in that part of the world. And that was all part of that was part of my early life.
I've never read any of your novels before, and so when it came in the mail, I thought, okay, is this going to be a political thriller set in Washington, D.C., and full of contemporary characters? And then I read it, and I thought, oh, I wonder if, is novel writing a kind of escape from all of that for you?
Well, not really. I mean, it is, but it isn't why I write novels. I've been writing fiction in parallel to doing my journalism since I was 16, 17 years old. I've always done that. And but I don't consciously say, oh, my goodness, now I'm going to escape from the heavy burdens of all these great issues that I'm dealing with, and I'm going to make up stories about trains and, you know, going from Chicago to Los Angeles. It's not that. But it in fact, does do that for me. There's no question about it. And because the way I write, which is a little bit every day, it means that my novels don't, when I'm working on them, they don't get cold or whatever. And because I've been doing daily journalism as long as I have, I can go from a dead run to a dead run to a dead run. And so I don't lose a lot of time and or space going from one to the other. And they complement each other in that they both involve the written word. They involve people in different situations. As a journalist for almost 50 years, there's not any kind of person I haven't met. And so when it comes time to making up characters for my novels, I know I have a wide range of people to choose from as patterns if I want to. And so it's all of a piece.
You've been covering the news for so long. I just have to ask you, what are some of the most memorable stories that you've covered?
Well, the single most memorable story was the assassination of John F. Kennedy in November 1963. I was a reporter then for the Dallas Times-Herald. And was intimately involved in that day's coverage because it was an afternoon newspaper. The president was only going to be in Dallas for 3 or 4 hours. Our whole staff was involved in the coverage. And but I was the federal reporter, so after I did what I did that day, then for the next 6 months, I did nothing but assassination stories. And the important thing about the Kennedy assassination for me, because I was a young reporter at the time, I learned right there, once and forevermore, just how fragile it all is. Here's a few shots fired, killed the president of the United States, literally changed the course of history, and also changed the lives of thousands, millions of people as a result. And from that point on, I always, on any given day, anything can happen, good or bad. But this is just part of the world in which we live, and if you're in the journalistic part of that world, which I am and have been since then, and still I am to this day, I'm always aware that at any given moment there can be a 9/11, there can be just fill in the blanks. But the Kennedy assassination taught me that forevermore, that about the fragility of life itself.
Is that a story that you've followed through the years? I mean, there's been obviously so much mystery that has remained since that incident.
I used to follow it very carefully. Because all the journalists in the world who were involved in that story, and I include myself, we had one purpose and one purpose only, and that was to prove there was a conspiracy, that the Warren Commission was wrong. And after many, many years of dealing with all of that, I came to a conclusion that it's still possible that there might be somebody turn up or some situation turn up that would demonstrate that there was a conspiracy, that Oswald did not operate alone. But as we sit here today in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in the year 2010, that has not yet happened. So it may be that the simplest solution may in fact have been the solution.
We're talking to Jim Lehrer of PBS NewsHour and novelist. His latest book is called Super. So we're living in a moment, as you know better than most of us, a very great change in the delivery of news and the business model of news because of the rise of digital media and the continued existence of television and radio and print media. How is PBS NewsHour responding to all these changes?
Well, we're responding in every way we possibly can. We tweet, we Twitter, we do everything. We're involved in every new media there is, because we take the position that, for years and years and years, we were an appointment television program. It was 60 minutes long, and you watched us when it was available, and that was it.
And still are to many people.
Exactly. And we always will be that. But what we have also done is spread our wings horizontally. And I take the position very strongly that we are first and foremost a serious journalism organization. I don't care if somebody watches a segment of the NewsHour or the whole NewsHour or on a pink iPod. I don't care how they get it, as long as they get it, as long as they get the serious information. And we're everywhere. We're in the new world. This new world requires a tremendous amount of collaboration and coalition and cooperation. Whether we're in print, or whether you're in television, whether you're on online, whatever in the world you're doing, if you're in the serious journalism business, we need each other. We need to figure out ways to amortize the costs of serious reporting. Somebody goes to the Santa Fe City Hall, a reporter may work for a newspaper, but may also work for a television station, may also work for a radio station, may also do blogs, may do all kinds of things. And the costs of that, where not one of those organizations could afford to do that, but they can if they get their acts together, really together. And and that is what we're doing at the NewsHour. We are in the business of making anybody who either has proven credibility or will submit themselves to our journalistic standards, and they have contributions they want to make, they're welcome, and welcome to come to our door and see what we can do, if they're in the same business we're in, which is in the journalism business.
I was reading an article in the New York Times that was talking about how the web and digital part of NewsHour and the broadcast part of NewsHour at a certain point came together in the same office.
That's right. We used to be separate. And we discovered, did some surveys, and what led us to know for a fact that we had to do some things differently. 40% of the people who watched the NewsHour, the television program, did not go to the online NewsHour. 40% of the people who went to the online NewsHour did not watch the broadcast. And so we now are blatant about it in terms of getting, maybe a story starts on the NewsHour, you want more about it, you can go online. Something starts online, so far this started in December when we really put the thing together. The early signs are since December that it's working. People are swinging back and forth and all that. I'm even blogging on this trip I'm taking, which I had never thought I would ever do, and I'm enjoying it. I did I did a webcam on Skype from a hotel room in Albuquerque yesterday, talking to Hari Srinivasan, who's our online reporter in our newsroom back in Washington, and talking about people I've been talking to, because I've been traveling for 2 weeks doing book and station visits, and it's been really fascinating.
During the presidential debates, and which I watched glued to the television set. One thing that I noticed was you trying to get the candidates to talk to each other. And that attempt seemed to me to symbolize that attempt to bring together polarized Washington and our polarized nation. What do you think is necessary for, I mean, and I'm actually getting a little bit unhappy with the metaphor of right and left, but that's what we've got. What do you think is necessary to bring right and left together in really constructive dialogue in this country?
Well, you got to remember that the dialogues between right and left are only 10% on the left and 10% on the right. The big 80% in the middle are the people who actually control the country. We're listening, we're hearing from the two fringe segments. Because there's a lot of real unrest in the country. People are losing their jobs, and they're not sure they're going to get another one. Homes are being foreclosed on them, and people are worried about, are their kids going to be able to go to college? They're worried about if they're going to lose their health care. There are people still dying in our names in war. These are real things. And when you have a real problem in our country, or problems in this case, you have unsettlement. People are worried. They're concerned about things. Well, what that breeds is legitimate opinion and legitimate disagreement about things in the political system. And everybody, this guy they're on the left has a solution, the person on the right has a solution. And with that exchange of views, vitriol rises, division rises, and it's always happened. Look back what happened in Vietnam. I mean, this is a piece of cake compared to what the country was, the things that were said to about each other and to each other by fellow Americans was extraordinary. This is nothing compared to that.
Really?
That was a real issue. I mean, people really cared about that war on both sides and all kinds of sides in between. And then when the thing went away, the vitriol went away. The divisions in the politics went away. Now, the same thing could happen this time. And being specific on the news media, you have cable television networks, ones from the left, ones from the right, whatever. They have pretty much capped out in terms of their audiences. It's millions and millions of people are still watching the nightly news programs on commercial television. They dwarf the audiences of the left. Of MSNBC and the right on Fox. And know the big middle out there, they want to know what's going on. They'll listen a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, and they hear the shouting and all of that. But informed society requires information. And that information's got to come from people who are trustworthy and who are straight reporters. And that is still the major function of journalism.
One of the most important stories of our time, I think, is the influence of money and corporate lobbies on the political process. And there you are as a respected major news organization, and on the one hand, you have to cultivate relationships with the politicians who are benefiting from this system, which is so very driven by money. And on the other hand, you have to report on that, you have to expose the corruption that's inherent in the system. How do you play both sides of that?
Yeah, I don't see it as playing both sides. It's just what we do. I mean, it's like doctors work on people who are sick. Lawyers represent people who need legal representation. Journalists report on what's going on, and the corporate influence, the special interest is an interest that isn't yours. And you could argue that on the left, let's say a school teachers union. Has interest, they lobby, that's a special interest. Goldman Sachs has a problem with on financial reform, they lobby, that's a special interest. But if you're in the financial industry having a special interest, that's your interest. If you're a school teacher, that's not a special interest, that's your interest. And the issue about money and all of that, bottom line is, you got to look at what the end results are. All this stuff, all this money, the special interest and whatever, healthcare reform did finally get passed. All this money is affecting politics and whatever. Barack Obama did get elected president of the United States. I mean, this is a messy, difficult system that these people created in 1776. And it's like a big rubber band. It's got, pulls and pushes and whatever, but the rubber band hasn't broken yet. And it's always push and pulls and all of that sort of stuff. But the public, the people who really run the country, they usually figure it out, and things work. But it is really difficult, and sometimes it gets nasty, and it gets it has power against power, and sometimes when power clashes with power, people get hurt. But that's also called democracy.
We're talking to Jim Lehrer of PBS NewsHour. What do you think are the greatest challenges to democracy? I mean, obviously, a free and honest press is a prerequisite for democracy.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What are the challenges that you think we're facing to the democratic process in our country right now?
Well, that's it. I think Thomas Jefferson said, without an informed electorate, you don't have democracy. It won't work. It just will not work. And so when the free press is in jeopardy, and in a state of revolution as it is now, the whole system has got a difficulty that it's got to overcome. And I consider that a big problem right now. But we're working on it, and it is being worked on. The average American is saying, you know, it's tired of being shouted at. And they're the ones who are now saying, hey, well, wait a minute. Maybe we need a whole new school of gatekeepers. Gatekeepers used to be like me. You know, all of them were old white men. Well, those days are over. But the old days were old white men who were newspaper editors, and you got your news. Most Americans got their news from their local newspaper, and they watched the three nightly news programs, all anchored by old white men. And then they read Time and Newsweek, all edited by white men, and that's the way it used to be. Those days are gone forever, thank God. But in the process of this great thing, this great proliferation of information and opinions and access to anybody's ear and mouth, a new system has yet to take form, where nobody wants to spend all day sitting in front of a computer screen, reading blogs or watching cable television or listening to people scream on the radio, but they still want to know about the new stuff. They want the new voices to be heard. Well, there's got to be a developing. What is beginning to develop is a whole new set of people who are going to do that for certain sets of people. We have to develop trust. Most people have to develop trust in them, and they're going to do it. And it's going to be, some of it's going to be print, some of it's going to be online, some of it's going to be combinations thereof. But it's coming back because we need it.
It's interesting. I got a lovely letter from a listener who said, every possible thing is available on the internet, but it takes so much time to sift through it, sort through it. So I listen to your program from 8 to 9, and I always get something that I need.
That's it. That's what's there. The University of Michigan libraries just put 7 million books on Google. The University of Minnesota just put one. Now, these are tremendous things. Who's going to go and look at those? Who's going to get this information for people? That's going to create a whole nother group of people who are going to be the information seekers. And a whole new set of librarians who are looking at books online for millions and out of millions and millions of books, and looking for little pieces of information that people need.
Yeah, it's always this question of, you have an archive, but then how do you access the
Absolutely.
Archive to get what you need?
We're not there yet. We're not there.
Yeah, well, and the business model is a big question.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. The books that they're putting online on Google are books that are out of copyright. They still haven't made quite enough deals yet for the new books, fresh books, that are still in copyright. All of this, I mean, we're in a state of absolute revolution on this, and it's a good revolution, but it's really difficult when you're, like all revolutions, you're in the middle of a revolution, you can get hurt.
Well, and the question is, really, I think, how you foster a thoughtful and responsible and truthful public dialogue in a climate where there are stories like global warming deniers and Obama's birth certificate and things like that get airplay. They get real airplay, and a lot of people believe that.
Well, they get airplay, but not very many people believe that. Every survey you said, a very small minority of the American people believe the birther thing or believe the deniers on it. They get a lot of volume attention, but they don't get a lot of thoughtful attention. I mean, you've got to, if somebody can prove this, you know, but it's dying. These things die. They die of their own weight. They die of their own screaming. because, oh my God, well, because somebody can then go to the internet and say, you know, that's not true. And so, next, and right. It goes on.
And
that's the good thing about the new information explosion.
One of the problems or tensions that's inherent in commercial media is, okay, you have a newspaper or TV or radio station, and then you report on a story that shows the dark side of one of your advertisers. Well, do you run the story or not? That's an age-old inherent problem of the division between, or sometimes lack of division between editorial and advertising. What about PBS? What kind of pressures do you have either from funders or from politicians on PBS?
None. Zero. In 35 years, we've never caught any kind of pressure from any corporate funder, any foundation funder, nobody at PBS or CPB or any other organization. We are the most independent news organizations there are, the ones in public broadcasting. The ones I'm involved in, particularly the NewsHour, nobody's ever fooled with us. Because our independence comes from the fact that we are basically a membership-run organization, a membership controller. Somebody wants to fool around with us. The people in New Mexico who watch public broadcast say, hey, man, this isn't a federal agency. Leave us alone. This is our public radio station. This is our public television station. And the NewsHour is our national news organization. And so we are without problems like that. And I mean completely without problems like that.
Because I've read stories over the years, and particularly during Republican administrations, that they try to cut the funding for public broadcasting because they think it's too liberal and things like that.
Well, there have been times when people from the left, people from the right have tried to fool with us, and every time they try, it doesn't work for the reason I just explained. And people say, hey, wait a minute, this is not your political thing, friend. This belongs to us. You have to believe me, it's just not a problem.
It's heartening to hear that.
Okay.
But it's interesting to me when I think of the, again, I'm uncomfortable with the terms left and right because they refer to a room with an aisle down the middle, and there's a lot of issues that I think are transcendent of those things. But it seems to me also that they're not really parallel, because the right is about keeping American power and corporate power strong, and the left is about basically elevating the little guy, if you want to boil it down to simple terms, and those things aren't parallel. One has way more power than the other.
Yeah, but that's a very complex issue. You've really oversimplified things. I mean, there are exceptions to every one of the, although everything that, as you know, to every one of those. It's a balancing act, and as I say, based on my experience in 50 years of doing this, the real power is not on the left or on the right. The real power is in the middle, and that's 80% of the country.
So you recovered from heart surgery. You came back strong to NewsHour. What would you like to do in your remaining years of your career, and what would you like to pass on to the next generation of journalists?
Well, I want to continue to do what I'm doing. I'm one of the fortunate people that the two things I decided to do when I was 17 years old was to, one was to write fiction, the other was to do journalism, and I'm sitting here many years later and I'm doing it. And so I'll continue to do that until physically able to, till I breathe my last breath. In terms of passing what I want to pass on to journalists is the basic deep down belief that it's not about you, buddy. Bye. This is about the people we report on and about the people we report for. We are an integral part of the democratic process. Without honest journalists reporting back to the people about all levels of government, all levels of power, it ain't going to work. And anybody who's in journalism must go beyond the fact saying, oh, I'm going to be a star, I'm going to go, blah, 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 blah. Forget it. If that's why people go into journalism, please don't go. It is a noble service, but only if your state of mind is right and you understand why you go to City Hall every day, why you go to the State House every day, why you go to Congress, why you interview people of power. You're doing it there on behalf of the people, because they can't go. They don't have time to go to City Hall every day. You go on their behalf. They don't have time to go to Congress. You go on their behalf. And we are the representatives asking the questions they would ask if they were there. And period. And that's my message.
talking to young people these days, do you see a lot of interest in investigative journalism, in gumshoe journalism, and people going into those fields with enthusiasm?
No. No. It's and the problem is there are a decreasing number of places to go do that kind of journalism. And it's hard for somebody advising a young person, hey, you know, there's a great future out there for this. There is, but we're at a, you know, there are peaks and valleys and everything. We're at a valley point. They're cutting back. There are no jobs. They're not making new jobs except in this still being formed new world order of journalism. And so my advice to young people interested in doing this is it is help create a new traditional form of journalism. It's easier said than done, but it has to be done.
And it needs to be funded.
Yes, right. Absolutely right.
And the question is, where is that
going to
come
from? I know. And that's the, you know, with the print media, the newspapers in America, and I worked for newspapers first part of my career, they were all based on the funding of classified advertising and display advertising for grocery stores and cars. And then when the internet took that away, shoom, the whole thing went away.
Yeah.
And then the news organization said, "Oh well, we'll go online. We'll be hip. We'll adapt to the new world order." Well, what they did is give away the only thing they had of value, which was their journalism. And now they're trying to put the genie back in the bottle, and it's difficult. So we're in a state of flux.
Jim Lehrer is executive editor and anchor of PBS NewsHour, and once again, he's the author of 3 plays, 2 memoirs, and 20 novels. His latest novel is called Super, and he will be at Bookworks in Albuquerque tonight at 7 o'clock. For more information, you can call Bookworks at 505-344-8139. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Pleasure is mine. This is great.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm happy now to welcome Red Sell. He is the founder and curator of The Process here in Santa Fe, and Tetsuki Ijichi, founder and owner of Tide Point Pictures. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello.
Hello, and ohayou gozaimasu. I mean, good morning.
Well, this is a wonderful introduction and a wonderful good morning to something that is happening at the screen at the College of Santa Fe, one of the most wonderful movie theaters in Santa Fe, and that is the Asia Now film series, and we're going to be talking in a moment about the first film that's coming up in this film series on Sunday. But Red, how did you come across the idea of doing a series of contemporary Asian cinema?
Well, a mutual friend of ours from a filmmaker here in town who recently moved here introduced us, and I went and I looked at the archive of films that Tide Point Pictures owns and distributes, and I was just shocked at how many of these films I really loved, and I came and had a meeting with Tetsuki here and decided we need to be showing these films here in Santa Fe. We don't get enough contemporary Asian film here in Santa Fe, and Tetsuki was glad to jump on board and open up his archives.
So, and then we came up with for doing this. Yeah.
And so you have this distribution company called Tide Point Pictures. How did you come across all the different films that you are distributing in Tide Point?
I started this company back when in 1996 in California. And I am native Japanese, but I moved from there to the States at that time. And then I started this company. And my concept is to bring more contemporary Japanese film and Asian film from Asia to this country.
And so between the two of you, you're putting together a series that represents a whole spectrum of countries, including North Korea?
Yeah, could you talk about that, Tom?
Yeah, you know, I can give a little bit about the movie. This is a documentary by a woman whose father supports the North Korean government. So this is an interesting award-winning film from Sundance Film Festival 4 years ago.
Yeah. And it's called Dear Pyongyang?
Oh, yes. I forgot the title. Yeah, Dear Pyongyang.
Now, that's not the one that we're going to be... And we'll probably talk about that in the future, because I'd like to have you both on again and talk about the films as they come.
Sure.
It's the second Sunday of every month.
Second Sunday each month at the screen.
At the screen.
At 8 o'clock. And the first one that we're going to be showing is Late Bloomer.
Now, I have watched a chunk of Late Bloomer, and I have not seen the ending yet, so I won't spoil it for anybody, but this is an incredible film. It's a black-and-white film shot with a lot of handheld camera. Tell us a little bit about the film.
Well, I found this film really interesting because it stars an actual severely handicapped person in a role that you never see people like that in. It's still about his affliction, like most movies about handicapped people are, but instead of, you know, just talking about how strong he is and that with his affliction, you see him slowly go mad in this film, and it's a beautiful descent into madness, is how I'd put it. And it has got a great soundtrack.
It has a great soundtrack.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the filmmaker Go Shibata loves music, and he wanted to bring good or young Japanese independent music scene to the his film. Yeah, and interesting is the star of the this movie is also disabled.
So he has cerebral palsy.
Yeah, yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
It really gives an authenticity to the role.
Yeah, and he's an amazing actor. Mm-hmm. He's somebody with cerebral palsy to the point where he speaks through a little machine that he presses buttons and it speaks for him.
He counts on people for his day-to-day existence.
Yeah, he's absolutely dependent on other people, mm-hmm. which for any of us might send us into a spiral into madness.
Right, right. And what sets him off in this is a love story. He falls in love with one of his caretakers, and she falls in love with a different caretaker of his, and he just can't handle it.
Right.
Yeah.
Great movie, highly worth seeing, and it's worth seeing just for the cinematic quality of the film and the, you know, mm-hmm. plot and the whole. But also to give us a sense of, well, does it give us a sense of Japan today in some ways?
You can see the movie setting, you know, drama setting. This is a part of the kind of ordinary Japanese residential area. Maybe, you know, we can't see here exactly similar, you know, residential area. But it is a kind of, how do I say, maybe middle class residential people. Area. Mm-hmm.
Middle-class residential people going about their lives, mm-hmm. and also the music that is happening in this underground scene right now.
And what one of the things that we're trying to do with this series is give a wide variety of films. This first one that we're showing, Late Bloomer, is a very difficult but yet beautiful film. And some of the other ones that we're showing, like Dear Pyongyang, and I think the next one that we're showing is Taking Father Home, are really socially important, relevant movies. You know, so we're showing everything from like heartbreaking, beautiful films to really cutting-edge cult films.
Is Late Bloomer a cult film?
I would. That's difficult.
Yeah, you know, we can't say exactly cult film, but it has a cult followers, so
yeah.
I would say, yeah.
Well, if it has cult followers, that makes it a good candidate.
I just wanted to get across that, you know, there's such an amazing variety of Asian cinema out there that isn't your standard, you know, samurai kung fu kind of Asian film that when you say Asian film, that's what a lot of people think. And some of the best work in the world is being done in Asian countries around the world.
In all sorts of emotional tones and on mm-hmm. all sorts of themes.
Yeah, and also I would like to add, you know, the since I came here, I mean, came to this country, you know, I have seen people talking about Kurosawa, Ozu, or any other samurai movies.
Right.
So I was a little bit disappointed with that situation. So I would like to show more contemporary Asian Japanese film to the, you know, North American audience.
Yeah, it would be like if we went abroad and people said to us, "Oh, I love your great director Alfred Hitchcock."
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is true and which is great, but that's not.
But there's a lot more than that.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the Asia Now film series kicks off this coming Sunday at the Screen, which is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. It's at 8 o'clock, one show only. For more information, you can call 505-473-6494. Is there a website with all the upcoming films and showtimes?
There is a Facebook page for it. If you type in Asia Now Film Series into Facebook, it'll pop right up.
Excellent. Tetsuki Ijichi is the founder and owner of Tide Point Pictures. Red Cell is the founder and curator of The Process here in Santa Fe. And once again, Go Shibata's Late Bloomer this Sunday at 8 o'clock. We'll see you there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Arigato.
I'm happy now to welcome Angelo Jaramillo. He is the Northern Regional Coordinator for New Mexico Gear Up, and Jennifer Vasquez, who is a student at Capitol High, and they're here to talk to us about Cinco de Mayo. Bienvenidos.
Bienvenidos. Thank you.
Bienvenidos. So, there is an event coming up, although today is actually the 5th of May, Cinco de Mayo. This coming Saturday, the 8th of May, at Warehouse 21 in Santa Fe, there's going to be a big youth and music and arts festival. Tell us about what's going on.
We collaborated with Warehouse 21 through a community partnership with New Mexico Gear Up and Warehouse 21 and Capitol High School. Probably about a year ago or so, to do some programming with students from the south side of Santa Fe. And so about a year or two later, the idea came up to put on a Cinco de Mayo music and arts festival for the youth, and this would be the first annual since it's never been done. So for about the past 2 months, we've been working together with Warehouse 21 and probably about 15 core students who have been showing up on a consistent basis to participate in youth entrepreneurial service training, which is part of the YES program at Warehouse 21. And it consists of numerous workshops of anywhere from digital media arts to filming to silk screening to concert and event organization or coordination. And also there's a mentorship program that we have built into that workshop as well over the last month and a half, 2 months, to actually produce this event, which is going to culminate this Saturday on May 8th.
And what is your role, Jennifer?
Well, my role in the Cinco de Mayo is that we're trying to organize everything, organize the bands that are going to be playing, getting decorations, inviting people to come to the annual Youth Music and Arts Festival that we're having this Saturday.
What are some of the bands? What kind of music?
Well, we're going to have DJs from reggaeton, Mexican music. We're going to have rock, techno. There's going to be flamenco. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be mariachis. And then there's going to be La Promesa. It's going to be playing also. And it's a big Mexican band.
What kind of La Promesa, what kind of music is that?
Mexican music.
Like traditional?
No, like Duranguense, cumbia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So tell us about Angelo's Cinco de Mayo. This is a something that everybody's heard of. Probably most people don't know the history of this day.
Right. Most people seem to confuse it with the independence of Mexico from Spain, which was actually, ¿cómo se dice? 16 de septiembre. Right, and that was 1821. But Cinco de Mayo is actually a celebration of La Batalla de Puebla, which is the Battle of Puebla, in 1862, when the French army decided to invade Mexico, and it was a relative of Napoleon, actually, Archduke Maximilian III, who they installed as emperor at the time for a very short-lived, brief period, because it was the celebration of a small militia of Mexican patriots that resisted against an overwhelming French army and actually pushed them out of Mexico. And the reason the French invaded was because at the time there was a lot of strife internally within Mexico, and they owed a lot of debts to a lot of different European countries, and the French used that as a pretext to actually invade the country.
Wanting basically its territory.
Exactly. They figured if they're not going to get the debt paid, then they're just going to take over and, you know, probably exploit the land and the people. Like many other European countries had a tradition of imperialism, basically. So to me, I think that the real significance is that it was a major victory of a small group of indigenous Mexicans, once again pushing out a major European constituency and saying no más.
And so on a day like Cinco de Mayo or the 8th of May, that you're going to do the celebration at Warehouse 21, it's, among other things, an opportunity for young people of Chicano and Mexican descent to really share their and celebrate their common roots.
I'll definitely say, and actually I'd like Jennifer to comment a little bit after I just say something, is a big push behind this project was actually to expose a lot of students of Chicano Latino descent, Mexicana, living on the south side of town, to really show them that the resources at a place like Warehouse 21 are very available to them to actually develop themselves, develop any products. It's not just about art-oriented. There's a whole business component to it as well. And also to bring a little bit more integration within the city youth as well, and family too. It's open to everybody from 4 to midnight, and it's a free event. There's going to be food served as well. But the students at Capital High School in particular, working with them, it's to allow them to empower themselves to be able to bring their culture, their background, and to be able to celebrate it with the rest of the city. And I think if Jennifer might be able to offer a little individual perspective on that, that'd be helpful.
Well, I think that, like Angelo said, a lot of people don't know the significance of Cinco de Mayo. So we need to open and, like, let people know what it is, that it's not their independence. It's because they won a battle that they've been fighting for, that they fought for years. And we need to let, like, people, our young teenagers, come, and for them to have fun and to also celebrate a culture that many people don't know that really exists.
What is the culture like, so to speak, at Capital High? I mean, are the students well integrated, or do people kind of hang out in their cliques according to, you know, the Mexican students hang out together and the Chicano Latino students hang out together? What does it look like?
Yeah, it does. It looks like you see jocks and everything with jocks, and then you see Mexicans, like, with their little cliques. It's like they don't share that much time that they should be sharing. Everyone's, like, their own thing, or because many people, they're like, wow, they're Mexicans, or whatever.
How do you deal with that? As a, you know, you're in a mentor role, Angelo.
For me, personally, it's always been about, we're the same brothers and sisters. The only thing that divides us is a flag or an interpretation of history. And it's basically when Kearney marched in here shortly after the Mexican-American War, planted the American flag and told the Mexican residents here, you can either stay or you can go, but if you stay, you're going to be under our thumb and our rule. And we all know what happened shortly after that. So I think there's a real misconception and misunderstanding, especially amongst Latino people who are born here or born south of the border, that somehow we're separated. But I don't see it that way. I see it as welcome back home, you know, and let's get to know each other and figure this thing out.
So you are the Northern Regional Coordinator for New Mexico Gear Up. What is that?
Gear Up is a nationally funded college readiness program, the largest in the United States, administered out of the U.S. Department of Education. And it works primarily with underrepresented communities, which means mostly minority or low income. And it's to increase the post-secondary enrollment rate of these kinds of populations.
And so what do you actually do?
We do everything from academic interventions to forming community partnerships to doing outreach with parents and families. And basically we work both with the schools and with the individual stakeholders, meaning the students themselves and their families, to try and bring more awareness and then to also bring more programmatic opportunities so that they can actually have access to college and make it a reality and not just a faraway dream.
Are you college bound?
Yes. Yeah, well, Angelo's been working with us. I'm a sophomore at Capital High.
Okay, so you've got some time.
Yeah, he's been with us since freshman year. And
So the Cinco de Mayo celebration is this Saturday, the 8th of May at Warehouse 21. For more information, you can call 505-989-4423. Jennifer Vasquez and Angelo Jaramillo, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features the monthly Women in Jazz Hour. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.